Today's presenting sponsor is SimpliSafe Home Security. The news cycle may feel relentless, but worrying about your home security doesn't have to be. Whether you're following the latest political updates or need a break from the headlines, SimpliSafe provides proactive protection so you can enjoy some peace of mind. With SimpliSafe, millions of Americans enjoy greater security and peace of mind every time they arm their system when heading out each morning or when locking up each night. Traditional security systems only take action after someone has already broken in. That's too late. SimpliSafe's Active Guard outdoor protection can help prevent break-ins before they happen. If someone's lurking around or acting suspiciously, those agents see and talk to them in real time, activate spotlights, and even contact the police, all before they have the chance to get inside your home. No long-term contracts or cancellation fees. Monitoring plans start affordably at around $1 a day, 60-day satisfaction guarantee, or your money back. As we know, Lovett set up a SimpliSafe all by himself, figured it out, and it has protected him and Pundit for years now. So, endorsed by John Lovett. What more could you want? Visit simplisafe.com/cricket to claim 50% off a new system with a professional monitoring plan and get your first month free. That's simplisafe.com/cricket. There's no safe like SimpliSafe. Welcome to Pod Save America. I'm Jon Favreau.
I'm John Lovett.
Tommy Vitor.
On today's show, we got Elon Musk calling Social Security a Ponzi scheme on Joe Rogan the same weekend Donald Trump announces he wants to spend our tax dollars on a strategic crypto reserve, which is definitely not a Ponzi scheme.
No.
We also got new tariffs coming. Woohoo! Just as a bunch of new polls show that people actually don't think Trump's doing a great job bringing down inflation. And then, as Donald Trump prepares to give his big speech to Congress Tuesday night, we'll talk about the new debate on the left about how Democrats should be pushing on Trump and whether they should be pushing back at all. But first, guys, we got to talk about the absolute shit show of an Oval Office meeting on Friday where Trump and J.D. Vance ganged up on Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, an ally whose country has been fighting off an invasion by Vladimir Putin, a brutal dictator who used to be our adversary. Hopefully you all got a chance to hear the bonus episode Tommy and Ben did about this over the weekend. A lot has happened since then. After Zelensky was basically kicked out of the White House because J.D. Vance didn't think he was sufficiently grateful for U.S. support, didn't say thank you enough, Zelensky flew to London to meet with European leaders about negotiating a peace process that doesn't entail just giving Putin everything he wants. Meanwhile, the Russians could not be happier. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said on Sunday that the Trump administration is, quote, rapidly changing all foreign policy configurations. This largely aligns with our vision. Hard to argue with that after Axios reported that Trump was set to hold a meeting with J.D. Vance, Marco Rubio, and National Security Advisor Mike Waltz to talk about the idea of cutting off American aid to Ukraine altogether. Waltz told Fox News, quote, the American people's patience is not unlimited, their wallets are not unlimited, and our stockpiles and munitions are not unlimited. If you're wondering how Republicans are feeling about all this, especially previously pro-Ukraine Republicans, here's a sample of their reaction to Friday's blowup.
Millions of American hearts swelled with overflowing pride today to watch President Trump put Zelensky in his place.
Instead of showing gratitude, he interrupted and berated his hosts.
Am I embarrassed about Trump? I have never been more proud of the president. I was very proud of J.D. Vance.
It's going to be Putin and President Trump and the people on our side that will end up making this decision for the future of Ukraine.
Look, this is one of the great moments in the history of American diplomacy.
Jesus. These fucking... Was that
start and end with Stephen Miller?
Yeah. I think we know it swelled during that meeting, Stephen Miller.
These,
relax.
These real housewife fucking... Luann wasn't grateful enough for the invitation.
Also, Donald Trump didn't give Ukraine really any aid, and J.D. Vance voted against the supplemental spending bill for Ukraine aid. So who are we thanking exactly?
I love Tommy Tuberville there. I'm assuming that was him, who said, yeah, it's going to be Trump, Putin, and everyone on our side deciding. It's like, what? What are we?
Our side?
Tommy, now that you've had more time to process what happened on Friday, do you have any other thoughts on the fallout and whether things have gotten better or worse since then?
Yeah, so I think in terms of Zelensky's efforts to get more support from the U.S. or get some sort of security deal, you just mentioned a way where it got worse in the near term, because it sounds like they're freezing an additional, they're freezing some more money that could be transferred over to Ukraine in terms of weapons stockpiles. But the bigger picture problem that Zelensky has is that Trump and J.D. Vance just want a deal, and they don't care about the substance of the deal. They don't care if the Russians end up occupying 20% of Ukrainian territory, or if Ukraine is told that they can't have a real armed forces going forward, so they're just kind of a sitting duck sitting there. Like, Trump just wants a win in the Western press. Now, from Europe's perspective, I think maybe the meeting was clarifying, and maybe that could help Zelensky, because now there's all these reports that France and the UK are trying to pull together a European peacekeeping group that will give Zelensky a security guarantee after there is a peace deal, and that's what he really wants. So I think, like, the challenge going into that meeting, now that I've thought about it more, is the US media tends to forget that all these foreign leaders who come in have their own political considerations. And for Zelensky, like, that meeting going really badly and getting in a fight was not good. But a worse outcome for him would have been getting bullied into taking a ceasefire deal that leaves them vulnerable going forward when Putin decides to break a ceasefire agreement that he cuts just to kind of make Trump happy. And so it's a bit of a mixed bag. I don't know. The hopeful version is maybe the Europeans will get their shit together finally and give Ukraine what they need.
Love it. What was your take on the meeting? There's been a lot of speculation that Trump and Vance plan to ambush Zelensky. Maggie Haberman and other journalists who cover the White House are reporting that the Trump people are saying it was spontaneous. What do you think?
I have no idea. Like, part of this is just like, none of this makes sense, right? Like, none of like what they're saying aligns with what they're actually doing, right? Like, I'm trying to like separate, like, the meeting is disgusting, right? Like, this is fucking disgusting. This is a guy flying from a war-torn country. He basically saved his country in part by like sheer force of personality and personal bravery. Yeah. He flies across the world to the United States, our ally up until 3 months ago. Now he's trying to grovel for his country's life to sign a mineral deal that also doesn't make any sense. That doesn't include any security guarantees. He's agreeing to do it because he's just trying to get through another day with Donald Trump and J.D. Vance. He's sitting there. He's getting questions about why he's not wearing a fucking suit.
Marjorie Taylor Greene's boyfriend.
Trump apparently said to the press corps, "Oh, this guy dressed up today."
Yeah,
just talking shit. That was before the meeting.
And so, like, he's in a waking nightmare. Like, the question I have is, okay, let's say all this played out behind the scenes, right? Like, not in front of the cameras. Like, take away the aesthetics of it. It's like, you know, in the morning, Marco Rubio thought signing this mineral deal and ostensibly becoming more entwined with Ukraine was a good idea. By the afternoon, it's no longer a good idea, and everything Trump is doing is making sense. There's all these sort of like post hoc rationalizations for Donald Trump. Like, even in the days that have followed, like, you go like try to read about this meeting and it's people saying, is Trump abandoning the World War II order for spheres of influence? Like, no, he's just a careening asshole. And there's this whole intellectual framework like evolving around him to justify what he's saying. Like, even Vance in the meeting, he says, we tried the pathway of Joe Biden, of thumping our chest and pretending that the president of the United States' words matter more than the president of the United States' actions. And so, therefore, we're capitulating completely in our actions, right? Like, why does what follows from there a kind of diplomacy in which the aggressor is ignored, right? Like, let's say they do want peace. They do want a deal at all costs. Wouldn't that involve putting pressure on Vladimir Putin as well? Where is that? Like, you can't really make any sense around this because it's a bunch of people acting emotionally, trying to rationalize Donald Trump's various like ego-driven, grievance-driven, assumption-driven foreign policy. And so, like, we end up like having these serious conversations about these like fundamentally despicable and unserious people. That was my reaction.
Yeah, I don't think it was an ambush or planned. I think what was planned is both Trump and J.D. Vance don't like or respect Zelensky that much because, as Tommy said, they just wanted to get a deal. And I think they are just annoyed at the whole situation that they have to like go through all the motions here and they have to deal with him and treat him like he's an ally, right? Or that like he's an equal partner or even a partner at all. Like, I don't know if you, I'm sure you guys did this. I'm sure you did this, Tommy. Like, I went back to the transcript and read it like so many times to see where it went off the rails.
Yep.
Because it all, like, it was going fine. And then
it was at times a little bit chummy, even.
Little, yes.
And they're then joking about their
joking
disagreements.
About Europe, yeah.
And it starts, the bad part starts with the reporter asking Trump if he's too aligned with Putin, which is obviously a trigger for him, right? Like, that's just going to set Trump off. And like, that couldn't be pre-planned, right? And then Trump says, oh, you see the hatred he's got for Putin? Pointing to Zelensky. It's very tough for me to make a deal with that kind of hate. He's got tremendous hatred. So like, We start the meeting by Trump scolding the guy. Keep in mind, scolding the guy that he had just called a dictator twice over the past couple weeks. We're like complaining about Zelensky not saying thank you, and Trump has called this guy a dictator twice. So then he scolds him while he's sitting right there in the Oval Office for having too much hatred to do the deal. But then even Trump sort of like, you know, he's like, I just want to get a deal. I'm aligned with Europe. I just want to get something done. I got something done. And the whole thing probably would have gone away then if fucking J.D. Vance didn't jump in after Trump finished his answer.
He was the chief arsonist.
No one asked J.D. Vance for a follow-up answer on that. J.D. Vance just jumped in after Trump went and did this whole thing where you said, where he also just gets the whole timeline wrong. He's like, Putin invaded Ukraine after Joe Biden like just tried to talk tough and didn't engage in diplomacy. So Zelensky's like, well, that's not the timeline. Like Zelensky's basically like, yeah, well, he's been trying to invade the country and he's been like at war with us since 2014. And then he also throws in, by the way, during the first answer, and God bless, now President Trump will stop him.
Right.
Which was also nice.
I just say like, I respect Maggie's reporting, but there were at times where I felt like the headline was like, this wasn't an ambush, and then the substance of the story didn't back that up. For example, Lindsey Graham is running around telling everyone that he told Zelensky not to take Trump's bait. Well, if this wasn't a setup, then why would he be baited in the first place? And maybe that's an overly literal meaning, but like Trump's position is, you have to come into the Oval Office, you have to bow to my will, you cannot disagree with me, even about points of fact. And that's just not tenable for the leader of a country fighting for its existence. And so like, ambush, not an ambush, it was designed for domestic political consumption. Like J.D. Vance's speech was his chance to finally talk in a big boy meeting and lead the headlines 41 days into the administration, where Elon had been in ahead of him every other day. And then Trump at the end says, well, I think it was good for the American people to hear all that, and this will make for good TV. And if you want to make this all a private discussion about the substance, don't have the fucking pool spray in there for 45 minutes.
Yeah, there's one moment where Zelensky calls him JD, and then JD calls him Mr. President. Mm-hmm. And so like, you feel like it's quite personal, but like, none of this should be personal, right? Like, it's not just about Trump calling him a dictator. The United States sided with Putin a week earlier.
Yeah, at the UN.
At the UN. Like, these are supposed to be, it's all like Vance and even Rubio, like you go look, but we'll talk about Rubio more in a minute. But like, these guys were all like, the end of America's namby-pamby, soft, emotional foreign policy is over. We're doing hard-nosed decisions based on pure rationality. And it's like, if that's the case, a fit of pique in a meeting shouldn't matter. Well, it shouldn't matter at all. It's all, they are allowing this to be 100% personality-driven.
I liked David Sanger's piece on this, which is, he's basically arguing that the overall goal here is that Trump wants to normalize relations with Russia, and Ukraine is standing in the way of that. Zelensky's standing in the way of that. So with that larger context, any meeting was it like, it could have gone better in terms of the theatrics of it, but like, it was always going to be Trump being like, this guy is an impediment to normalization with Russia, which is what I want.
And it's like, why did we want to normalize things with Russia so much? It's like it's a broken economy. It's like a wartime economy now. They just make artillery shells that they use to kill Ukrainians. But one sort of under-discussed bizarre part of Trump's rant, because, you know, you also have to think about the original impeachment and how Zelensky was involved, right? Because Trump called Zelensky and was trying to held up military aid to Ukraine in order to get dirt on Joe Biden. But an under-discussed sort of part of when Trump gets really mad is he starts ranting about the Mueller investigation.
Yeah.
And he says, Putin went through a hell of a lot with me. And then he said, and it came out of Hunter Biden's bathroom. Like, so none of this made sense, but he was talking about how like he and Vlad endured something terrible together. Like somehow it was bad for Putin to have been perceived by the world as having handpicked the American president.
Like they're blood brothers. It's actually really, really strange. It's kind of like a Stockholm syndrome. Like, yeah, this is the thing. It's like, usually like, why would the U.S. want to normalize relations with Russia? And again, this is why like, this is, none of this makes sense. And like, all these sort of pathetic weasels around Trump trying to make it make sense are obviously part of the problem. It's like, no, of course not. It's a failing petrostate.
Well,
right? That it's like been depleted. It's like, America, it's so fucking pathetic that because of Donald Trump as a figure, a singular figure, we're now becoming a vassal state of this tiny, weak country. Because like, Donald Trump has these ego-driven, like psychosexual, personal issues with this one dictator who in his bones, he knows is so much tougher than him. And by the way, Zelensky too, right? Like, part of this resentment is that J.D. Vance and Donald Trump know that like, Zelensky is a stronger and tougher man than they are. And you can just feel the seething kind of like weakness of these two human beings in front of this actual leader.
He also, when he gets mad, when Trump gets mad, he just has like conspiracy Tourette's, and he just like goes through the, that's where that came from. Like where he just went down the road of like, Putin, Russiagate, Hunter, laptop, bathroom, video.
Yeah.
He's just, he doesn't know at that point.
He always got you what do you always call the FBI people that were sleeping together?
Struck and love. Yeah. The
lovers.
Yeah.
He almost got to the lovers.
Lisa Page and the love. Yeah. Adam, I'm surprised he didn't mention Adam Schiff and.
Sir, do you know it was on Hunter's laptop? There's a lot of photos that you probably don't want to see.
Yeah, there were a few incursions on there, but I don't think it had anything to do with what we're talking about.
5 more seconds, he would have gone there. Pod Save America is brought to you by ZBiotics pre-alcohol. Tommy, ZBiotics.
It's the best.
I mean,
don't drink without it.
What more can we say to people on this one?
Like, if you haven't tried it and you're over the age of 30, you're just an idiot.
And even if you're under 30, you know, if you just want to feel better the day after drinking and not feel like shit, ZBiotics is for you. The only, like I said, the only challenge is just remembering to take it.
Yeah, running out.
Yeah. ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic. It was invented by a PhD scientist to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works when you drink. Alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for your rough next day. Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. Just remember to make pre-alcohol your first drink of the night. Drink responsibly, and you'll feel your best tomorrow. Don't forget your ZBiotic. Get some now. Tell all your friends. This college hoop season, don't let anything sideline your celebrations. Wow, okay. Grab pre-alcohol before you go out and be ready to cheer on your team all day and night long. Go to ZBiotics.com/Cricket to learn more and get 15% off your first order when you use Cricket at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with 100% money-back guarantee, so if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Remember to head to ZBiotics.com/Cricket and use the code Cricket at checkout for 15% off. Let's talk about Secretary of State Lil Marco Rubio for a minute, who looked not excited to be in that meeting. As a reminder, here's an example of what Rubio used to say on Ukraine and what he's saying now.
Look, Putin can't win. No matter what, there always has to be a real, legitimate Ukrainian state that we have a relationship with. And I don't know why we can't begin to openly say we will support them as long as they are willing to fight, even if it's an insurgency.
Thoughts on Rubio?
I've noticed this in all of the photos of Rubio in the context of these U.S.-Russia talks. Like, there were a bunch of photos that came out of Saudi Arabia with, like, Rubio, Mike Waltz, Steve Witkoff are all there, and there's, like, Sergey Lavrov in the Russian delegation. Rubio just has this thousand-yard stare in all of them. And it, like, I don't want to, you know, put him on the psychiatrist's couch, but I do think, like, you can tell he knows this is wrong. Because I do think it's fair to say, okay, after 3 years of the Biden policy, we got to a place where it was a permanent stalemate, kind of. And a stalemate is not a strategy. So let's now reemphasize diplomacy and try to end the war. But Rubio knows Zelensky's not a dictator and Putin is. He knows who started the war and who didn't. He knows that Zelensky can't hold an election right now because a huge chunk of the country is living under Russian occupation. Another big chunk has been displaced. Another big chunk is at the front lines fighting. Like, well, how are they going to have people vote in free and fair elections in this context? And so he just looks like a guy who sold out all his beliefs to get the Secretary of State job and now is like living with the consequences and, by the way, has no real power.
Well, and that's what he looks like in all these pictures. He does sound like he's trying to sell this new Marco Rubio and how he thinks. I think we have a clip of him, what he says now.
What specifically do you want to see President Zelensky apologize for?
Well, apologize for turning this thing into the fiasco for him that it became.
Is he found every opportunity to try to Ukraine-splain on every issue?
Maybe Zelensky doesn't want a peace deal. He says he does, but maybe he doesn't.
Ukraine-splain?
The Ukraine-splain. Like, again, it's like it's so emotional, right? Like, oh, he should have been more. He should have shown better manners. Like this fucking Emily Post bullshit. I went back and looked at Rubio's the Senate confirmation speech that he gave. And he says the post-war global order is not just obsolete, it's now a weapon being used against us, right? And like, this is him, again, like trying to find a way to make sense of his involvement, right? And like, I do think that like, there is a critique of the way in which the Biden administration like didn't want to lose, but didn't want to win in a bunch of different ways all around the world.
Totally.
And by the way, like for decades, about like an America that's just slowly watching China grow more and more powerful as we welcome them into the economic order, which are things that he talks about, right? But like the other side of that is meant to be a stronger U.S., right? Like a more like a more full-throated, less morally relativistic defense of our values, of our principles, right? Like some kind of a strategy. But then you like you look at what's happening. It's like we're capitulating to Russia, and they're like, well, actually, it's because you know we're not going to worry about what's happening over there. We're going to worry about what's happening in our own backyard. Okay, but we're also basically threatening Canada with invasion, threatening Panama with invasion, throwing tariffs on our neighbors. Like, there's no logic to any of this. And Rubio, because he is just the fucking world's biggest weasel, is just trying to figure out what he can say day to day just to get him into a, I guess, a bet.
So I kind of think that there might be a logic to it. Can I give you my...
Sure.
Like, I think that Trump, and I don't think this is like Trump has planned out everything mm-hmm. and has been really thinking deep about this and writing it in his memoirs, you know. I think he respects rich, powerful, ruthless leaders. And it seems like he wants to carve up the world with Putin and Xi, and maybe you got your Kim Jong-uns in there or your BBs. Anyone with nuclear weapons, right? He knows that if you have nuclear weapons, then you're pretty powerful. And he knows they're bad guys. He knows they treat their people horribly. He doesn't really care about that. He likes the idea that he can deal with a few what he views as tough leaders directly. He thinks he's a great negotiator. He doesn't like the idea of the UN and NATO and places where you have all these voices in some countries that he doesn't think should have a seat at the table, an equal seat at the table with everyone else because they're weaker than the other countries because that's too democratic and he doesn't like democracy that much. And the idea of him, this is like when he always brags when like she came to Mar-a-Lago and, you know, and then he gets to wine and dine him and impress him and, you know, I'm good with Putin and Kim Jong-un likes me. Like I think he loves a world where he can deal with a few tough bad guys. He's a good negotiator, and he looks at and they do all want like client states. He sees like Putin wants Ukraine. Putin may want Eastern Europe. He sees Xi wants Taiwan, and he's like, well, I better get some client states of my own. Maybe I'll go after Canada. Maybe I'll go after Panama, Greenland. Like it feels like that's his vision of the world. I don't know. Maybe I'm crazy.
I was trying to find this Elon Musk tweet, and I was scrolling for like 25 minutes because, God, all he does is tweet. But he tweeted, Zelensky wants a forever war, a never-ending graft, meat grinder. This is evil. Like the way they talk about this guy, these are Zelensky's people getting killed. Yeah, the Russians tried to murder him repeatedly in the early days of the war. They sent assassination teams to Kyiv to find the guy, and he survived through bravery, through, you know, really tough fighting by the Ukrainians in those early days. And it's just disgusting the way they talk about him. But to your point, John, I mean, like, I think there's some truth that, look, between 50 and 85 million people died in the Second World War. So the United States was like, or the world came together and was like, hey, maybe we should set up some institutions to prevent this from happening again. That's why you have the UN. That was designed to try to maintain global peace. That led to the creation of NATO, which was to counter Soviet expansion and, you know, unchecked nationalism among some of the member states like Germany. And
always got to keep an eye on Germany.
You do. And both institutions have a lot of flaws, and we can talk about those if you want. But there hasn't been a war between a NATO member and Russia since. And no NATO member has been invaded by another country. So it's been a pretty successful project. And I agree, it does seem like Trump wants to go back to a time where the great powers divide the world up and they bully people and might is right. And I think the problem with that, there's a lot of problems with that logic, but what you're going to see is more militarism. You're going to see more nationalism. You're going to see more development of nuclear weapons as a deterrent. Because if the U.S. nuclear umbrella is not going to protect us, like, I guess it's time to make one of my own. And so it's gangster diplomacy. And you're already seeing Elon Musk tweeting about, he talks about the spoils of battle when he's talking about Doge cuts. But I do think he's applying that more broadly in like a really kind of, you know, old school in a bad way.
Like, this is how Trump operates domestically. This is how Trump has operated in business his whole life, right? Like, you don't have to have some grand theory of international order to just view the world as he does, as like, there's people I think are tough and powerful, and there's people I think are weak, and why should I give a shit about the weak people?
I think what you were describing is like the end result of what happens when someone like Trump is just sort of emotionally, instinctively driven towards relationships with Russia and Putin, with Xi, that he like finds that easier and less of a headache. But like, where are the iPhones from? You know, Like, where are the chips from? Like, all of this is like, the idea is like, oh, you're just going to carve up the world. There's stuff moving across those lines already, right? Like, the amount of chaos.
Well, he's going to be like, yeah, I can deal with Xi directly. I'll keep the iPhones coming.
Yeah, sure.
And oh, I realize it's all bullshit, but I think he believes it.
I think
it's a J.D. Vance viewpoint. I don't think it's just Trump. I actually think he now has an Elon and J.D. Vance in, like, I think he has a movement of people around him, and they're all, you know, they look to Orban, they look to Hungary, and they're like, this is the way.
I think they see, I mean, just take them at their word, like the UN, World Trade Organization, like these are institutions that have become sclerotic the same way and they don't see the benefits of or live in the kind of glib luxury of the security and stability these institutions provide while attacking what are genuine excesses and problems of working within those organizations. And rather than doing the hard grinding work of reforming them, they want to burn them down. But we will live in the dangerous kind of poor world that results when they're long gone. And Donald Trump doesn't know better, but Marco Rubio knows better because he used to know, he used to say it out loud.
Oh, for sure.
What one even just even simpler explanation is Trump looks at a Russia or a China and sees a kleptocracy. And there are people who think that Vladimir Putin's the richest person in the world because basically at one point along the way, he went to all the Russian oligarchs and says, now you give me half or else you're falling out a very high window.
Is he happy?
You can imagine a version of that where, you know, the state functions as just another means for Donald Trump to get paid. And we're already seeing some pieces of that.
And again, I completely agree. And in his mind, it's like, and I deserve that because I'm the one running everything. And I got my other rich friend Putin over here, my other rich friend Xi, and they're tough guys too. Look how tough, how many times are you talking about how tough they are? But sometimes the way that I think the left has framed it is, oh, that Donald Trump is like a supplicant to these guys, or he's like a stooge for them. And like that, I think Putin and Xi probably think that about Trump, but I think Trump thinks they're his buddies. They're all a bunch of tough guys, you know, standing straight across the globe together.
Like, yeah, this is why it's like, look, I the U.S. sides with Russia at the UN against our ally. And like, how many people in the U.S. actually know about that? And how many people in the U.S. actually care about that?
And like, by the way, and notable that Orban and Bibi joined too in the new club there in that vote.
But yeah. I do think like some of this is like, you know, I was thinking about this before we recorded. It's like, you know, the democratic legitimacy of these institutions, right? Like, were in the post World War II era came from Americans having a fear of the Soviet Union, drilled into them by propaganda, but also the actual threat posed by the Soviet Union that people lived with every day. And then the Cold War ends and we kind of just continue with these institutions, never really making a kind of coherent argument for them, why they're important, why we're doing this, why we spend this money, right? Like we were resting on the kind of goodwill and legitimacy that came from generations before. And now Trump puts these things under attack. And in the same way we're told it's a trap to talk about why USAID is a good thing, we're now once again in the trap of trying to defend this order because it seems like what Trump and these guys are daring us to do is say, all right, fine, burn it down. We'll prove you right when everything is terrible.
Yeah. We're just out in the streets chanting, rules-based order. Rules-based order.
Yeah, I bet no one knows about the UN vote. I mean, look, the UN Security Council has been broken for a long time because the Russians and Chinese veto whatever they want, and we veto any criticism of Israel, and nothing gets done, right? It's been that way for a decade plus. A UN General Assembly vote is basically just kind of like a show of hands of what you believe. It's like a global roll call, and boy, did we show our hand in a new and scary way to the world. I do wonder if the Zelensky-Trump meeting will break through and, hit people differently. Like, yeah.
They did say Slava Ukraine at the Oscars, but is that worth anything? No, nothing. Okay.
Bullying a man who's like trying to rescue 19,000 Ukrainian children who were stolen, kidnapped, and taken to Russia. Like, I don't know. That's pretty fucked up. That's dark stuff.
I'm sure MAGA base thought it was awesome, right? Of course, we know that they've been saying that. I agree, Tommy. Like, I think I had some people text me who like are not, you know, political junkies like us and are just like, that was so embarrassing, awful, scary. What the fuck is happening?
You don't look tough. It's like a 3-on-1 fight. And it's not about sending weapons or spending more money. It's just about like treating a man with decency whose country has been massacred. I mean, yeah. The casualty counts you see from the U.S. estimates are 70,000 Ukrainian soldiers killed, 100,000 wounded. The Russian casualties are like double that. And so this war has been a catastrophe. Like, I'm all for trying to end it, but we have to do it on terms that won't lead to a ceasefire that just reignites in a couple of years when the Russians have had time to reconstitute their forces. And that's what Zelensky's worried about.
Yeah, that's right. All right, turning to all the damage that Trump is doing here in America. The AP reported last week that the Social Security Administration is preparing to lay off at least 7,000 people, close multiple field offices, and could get rid of up to half its workforce. Most of the agency's senior leadership is already gone. Martin O'Malley, the former Maryland governor who ran the Social Security Administration under Biden, just told CNBC that with this level of cuts, quote, you're going to see the system collapse and an interruption of benefits within the next 30 to 90 days. People should start saving now. We also found out what Doge master Elon Musk thinks about the program during his latest Joe Rogan appearance last weekend.
Well, I mean, the government's one big permit scheme, if you ask me.
Yeah, well, you can tell me better than anybody.
Social Security is the biggest Ponzi scheme of all time.
Seems like the task of making the 2026 campaign ads just got easier.
It's also just like, Social Security is a Ponzi scheme. It's just like mid-90s Republican talking points is like where we're at. Like, it's actually a Ponzi scheme. The trust fund runs out in 2050. The trust fund's always running out.
Yeah, Elon sort of like always seems like partly aware of and on board with the Trump policy agenda. Like, no one in the White House wants him to call Social Security a Ponzi scheme because, boy, does it then go. It's hard to pivot from that to fighting for a $5 trillion tax cut for the richest people in the country, which is their primary objective this year.
I imagine they'll do whatever it takes to avoid Social Security benefit cuts because for they sure. know how unpopular it would be. But I also think they are some combo of idiots and liars all the time. So people do need to be on alert for any story about retirees who couldn't get their benefits on time, because that's, you lay off that many people at the Social Security Administration, which I'm sure wasn't the model of efficiency before that.
Yeah. Those Social Security checks gets paused, you'll see a geezer insurrection that makes a fucking January 6th look like a PTA meeting.
Oh, I remember Remember under the Affordable Care Act, you know, Obama used to say, if you like your plan, you can keep it. Mm. But then some plans were canceled because they didn't hit the mandatory requirements under the new ACA rules. And my wife's mother had a plan that got canceled. And I remember having that conversation with her. And, you know, she was able to get a new one and it was fine. It was probably overall better. But like, that was not a small thing. That was not a blip in their feelings about the ACA or Barack Obama's standing for a little while.
Yeah, and to that point, people aren't gonna, even if they don't cut benefits, like, oh, we missed all the checks for Wisconsin this month,
right? Oopsie.
Or sorry, everyone in Kansas, you're not getting, or like they, you do that for a month, it's mayhem.
Again, it's like I sound like a broken record, but like, you know, before Social Security, the poorest people in the country were old people. And Social Security changed that forever. We live in a world that is different because Social Security lifted millions of people out of grinding poverty. And like, you play with that for a week.
And they showed their
people's
gratitude.
Ability to feed themselves, to and take they, care of themselves.
And they showed their gratitude by voting for Donald Trump.
Yeah, well.
At least the first time. Well,
but like, part of what you're making is just a basic government competence argument. And, yeah. And you know, if suddenly a bunch of Social Security checks don't go out, that like shatters people's totally. Confidence in the U.S. government in a way that I think is really hard to recover from. And like, again, the Affordable Care Act, the healthcare.gov rollout was more than just a website being broken for a while. It just fundamentally undercut people's faith in the administration to roll out and administer their healthcare, which is a very personal thing.
Social Security field offices are not the driver of our national debt or deficit. These are tiny, tiny costs that provide basic services. It's all fake. It's all bullshit.
We're going to take a quick break, but one announcement before we do that. The first State of the Union address of Trump's second term.
No, it's
technically an address to a joint session of Congress, but whatever.
He has been president.
Fucking nerds.
Yeah, okay.
It's tonight at 9 p.m.
Eastern. We
used to
believe in things, have grammar and stuff.
6 p.m. Pacific. 1 hour before that at 8 Eastern, 5 Pacific, the three of us and Dan. Dan is back here again this week.
We make Dan fly down all the time.
We'll be live streaming a preview of the speech on the Pod Save America YouTube channel. We'll be talking about what we can expect from Trump and how Democrats should respond, and talking to Democratic members who are there. We'll also be taking questions from Friends of the Pod subscribers. It's going to be fun. It's going to be a great time. Then at 9 Eastern, 6 Pacific, head over to the Friends of the Pod Discord for a subscriber-only live chat where you can process this freak show in real time with people who get it. No deranged Facebook uncles. I don't know how we can promise that. No screaming into the void. Just a space to vent, fact check, remind each other that reality still matters.
Wow.
I know.
That's a lot to promise. It's going to be some jokes about the speech.
I did not write that, you can tell. To ask us questions during the live stream and for access to the Discord, sign up for Friends of the Pod now at Crooked.com/friends. It's the best way to support Crooked and everything we do. Pod Save America is brought to you by Lumen. Did you know that when your metabolism is working properly, you'll feel the benefits in literally every aspect of your life? Lumen is a valuable tool that can give you insights to create a healthy metabolism for your body. Lumen is the world's first handheld metabolic coach. It's a device that measures your metabolism through your breath. And on the app, it lets you know if you're burning fat or carbs and gives you tailored guidance to improve your nutrition, workout, sleep, and even stress management. All you have to do is breathe into your Lumen first thing in the morning, and you'll know what's going on with your metabolism, whether you're burning mostly fats or carbs. Then Lumen gives you a personalized nutrition plan for that day based on your measurements. You can also breathe into it before and after workouts and meals, so you know exactly what's going on in your body in real time, and Lumen will give you tips to keep you on top of your health game. Yeah, it's all the craze here at Crooked. The Lumens.
Yeah, people are using it in the morning, at night, for workouts, after workouts, to kind of do a little A-B testing.
Get yourself a personalized nutrition plan for the day. It's great. Because your metabolism is at the center of everything your body does, optimal metabolic health translates to a bunch of benefits, including easier weight management, improved energy levels, better fitness results, better sleep, and more. Lumen gives you recommendations to improve your metabolic health. Take the next step to improving your health. Go to lumen.me/crooked to get 20% off your Lumen. That's lumen.me/crooked for 20% off your purchase. Thank you, Lumen, for sponsoring this episode. So, same weekend Elon called Social Security a Ponzi scheme, Trump announced a safer place to invest our tax dollars, crypto. He posted that in order to, quote, make sure the U.S. is the crypto capital of the world, he's creating a crypto strategic reserve that would stockpile 5 cryptocurrencies, XRP, Solana, Cardano, Bitcoin, and Ethereum. Don't even know what half those things are. Tommy, care to explain what this is all about?
So the initial tweet said the reserve would include XRP, SOL, and ADA. That's Ripple, Solana, and Cardano. And then he quote tweeted himself saying, of course, it'll also include Bitcoin and Ethereum. And that will matter in a second. So this idea has been on like the top of the crypto Bitcoin maximalist wish list for a long time. Because if you own a lot of cryptocurrency early and then the US government pumps a lot of money into it, your Bitcoin is going to go up in price. The main elected official pushing this idea has been Cynthia Lummis, a senator from Wyoming, who I'm sure everyone here at this table has heard of.
Very well aware of Cynthia Lummis.
She introduced the Boosting Innovation Technology Competitiveness Through Optimized Investment Nationwide, or
Bitcoin?
NAMBLA.
Bitcoin.
I was trying to follow you as you were saying, and I'm like, ooh, get it. Okay, yeah.
So you put out the Bitcoin Act, the NAMBLA Act, as Lovett called it, at a conference in 2024 where Trump also spoke. Her bill is basically, she frames it as a way to bring down the debt, which makes no sense. But the gist of it is the U.S. government buys 1 million Bitcoins, which is about 5% of total supply of Bitcoins over a set period of time using existing treasury funds. They say it will be paid for by these existing treasury funds because it's like accounting gimmicks to make it sound like it's cost-free. The money is fungible. So if we're spending U.S. government money on Bitcoin, you're not spending it on something else. So obviously it's not free.
Well, it's only fungible if you consider it like a stable asset, like the fucking dollar.
Right.
But it's not. It's a
highly
like
volatile.
It's like it's buying stocks.
Yeah. So the reason I'm talking about this Lummis bill, though, is because there's no details of whatever Trump's plan is beyond these tweets, except that the Lummis plan was just Bitcoin, while Trump's plan included those other cryptocurrencies like Ripple and Cardano, which are why a lot of Bitcoin advocates actually don't like what Trump rolled out, because those other currencies are like jokes. Like no one uses Ripple. No one uses Cardano. Solana is like a platform through which you make other stuff off it, like meme coins. So the idea that like, if you are a Bitcoin maximalist and you believe that Bitcoin is the new gold, okay, I guess you could argue for diversifying like our holdings of stuff, but like not for this other shit coins that no one ever uses. So the only argument for how those other currencies get into the mix here is because special interest lobbying and corruption. And surprise, surprise, Trump had dinner with the CEO of Ripple in early January. He's now surrounded by these Silicon Valley guys with vested financial interests like David Sachs, the AI czar. So he tweets this out. Crypto prices spiked on Sunday about 10%. Now they're crashing down as we're recording this. And I guess there's like a big White House crypto meeting on Friday, but like there's a good chance that this tweet was all it was. And it was just a chance to pump and dump.
Oh my God.
If you're previously holding these shares, because a bunch of crypto news sites reported on someone making a 50 times levered bet on Bitcoin and Ethereum on Saturday, only to cash it out for a $6.8 million profit on Sunday. So must be nice. What do you think, guys? Clean out Fort Knox, fill it with thumb drives?
Well, I was going to say, what are we stockpiling?
Well, this is the thing that's so fucking so stupid.
It's not gold. It's not a, like, what are we, it's not a,
by the way, like,
we're going to run out.
We have a strategic reserve.
We're going to run out of the
oil.
We're going to run out of the fake money.
Yeah. Look, if the government ran out of crypto, what happens? What happens? Nothing. Nothing happens.
We're like, going to stockpile some grass.
Yeah. It's so outrageous on its face. Also, I know it's almost quaint now. Something that should probably take an act of fucking Congress.
I think it would require one, yeah.
And then the even just the announcing of the specific currencies, again, like if there was an actual serious, like a strategic crypto reserve is the dumbest fucking thing I've ever heard of. Yeah. It's not strategic, it's not a reserve, it's just a bank account that we'd be owning that we just put US dollars into, I guess hoping that, and then one of the other rationales you'll hear is like, well, it will benefit taxpayers because taxpayers would then own a share of cryptocurrency as it rises. And like, you know, I like hate to be a small C conservative here. There's a great way for taxpayers to benefit from cryptocurrency if they'd like. They can buy cryptocurrency
exactly.
with their own fucking dollars.
Yeah, exactly. Take the money in treasury that you're going to put in the reserve and hand out some tax cuts. I don't know.
Yeah, like, no, I don't want a sovereign wealth fund.
Give someone
I don't want
a crypto
any of this
certificate.
Shit. Yeah. Yeah. Everybody a gift card. Buy what a crypto you fucking want.
There's also no guarantee that Bitcoin price will rise. Like if it was guaranteed to rise, then like the way markets work is it would already be priced at that level, right? Because that's how guarantees work. I mean, so none of this makes sense. You could come along, create a new cryptocurrency that displaces Bitcoin. All of our holdings go to zero. Also, the US government holding a ton of cryptocurrency or Bitcoin is completely antithetical to like the libertarian anti-government roots of these cryptocurrencies.
Yeah. I thought the whole reason we're doing crypto and the blockchain is because we don't trust central governments and banks around the world, and we want, like, what was that whole thing?
And also, if the US government suddenly has massive holdings of Bitcoins, that's stuck, because if the US announces that we're selling off our Bitcoins, suddenly the price of Bitcoins
exactly.
will fucking plummet. Some of these currencies that Trump is talking about buying, if the US has any meaningful stake in it, we own a huge share of the global supply of these coins. You know, with these Trump meme coins, right? All these people that put money into it, they can only get that money out if somebody's willing to buy it at that price. Now, Trump makes money on the transaction fees. Mm-hmm. And if you want, you could probably, show your crypto wallet to Trump and say, look, I'm buying all your fucking coins, you know,
yeah.
just to get a great deal out of it. But like, so what this is like, this first, it's like so many, it's like a Russian nesting doll of corruption. Trump has these allies who are in the crypto business. He's doing a huge favor for them. Trump himself is making a ton of money off of crypto, right? And so he wants to have crypto succeed. And on top of all of that, you have this legitimated scheme where foreign leaders and governments and anybody who wants a government contract can basically put money virtually directly into Donald Trump's pocket. It's untraceable, but you can still show him. You can prove it to him.
Do you think after Trump and Elon and the Doge boys go to Fort Knox to check out the gold, they'll check out it feels like the Doge should kind of check out the crypto reserve if that ever gets off the ground.
The Fort Knox
That's a good
stuff.
Place for Doge.
Well, I don't know where this came from.
Well, now I'm starting to understand where it's coming from, because basically they're trying to equate having a holding, like a reserve of crypto, to having a reserve of gold. And they're trying to make the argument that gold is somehow just as insecure or dangerous or a risky asset to hold as these digital mining bucks.
Yeah, don't trust anything
yeah.
except that which makes us money.
Well, like to your point, like a strategic oil reserve makes sense because you're going to need to use oil. Like gold, yeah. You could make a similar
finite
argument.
Resource.
You could make the argument with crypto that you could make with gold. Like, look, in a pinch, we can't eat gold, right? It's only as value because for thousands of years it has had value. But Bitcoin's been around for like 15 years. It could just disappear and no one would know.
Yeah, like I don't care about the gold at Fort Knox, but I like the. It's not like you have oil because in an emergency, if suddenly oil supplies are cut off
right.
by our adversaries or there's a pressure or whatever, you need oil to have the economy function. Other than the strategic helium reserve. Because it's fun to use at parties. But like there's lots of, but like you have a reserve of something that you need in an emergency.
Right. And crypto is not what you need. Also, long term, cryptocurrency will undercut the use of the dollar as the world's reserve currency, which, long story short, gives us a ton of power and influence. And on the corruption part, I mean, I had this really smart reporter on named Zeke Fox on the February 26th episode of Pod Save the World, and I called him today just to, like, check back in on this. There's this guy named Justin Sun, you heard of him?
Yeah.
Chinese crypto entrepreneur. He bought $75 million worth of Trump's World Liberty Financial tokens. This is a certain crypto asset where the Trump family gets 75% of the profits from that coin. So there's a, right off the top, he just gets a rip of 75%. The SEC just paused its case against Justin Sun. They're investigating him for basically fraud.
Yeah, if you go to the world,
just woken up one day and decided they didn't have a case.
If you go to the World Liberty website, it's just Donald Trump on the front. He is called their chief crypto advocate. His sons are ambassadors in other fake roles. By the way, the SEC also paused a lawsuit against Binance. It stopped an enforcement action against Coinbase. They are stopping the SEC's crackdown that was led by Gary Gensler under the Biden administration. So basically, they are removing any brakes. They're removing any guardrails, any transparency. They're going to make this, make it basically impossible to detect fraud, to detect corruption. Like, that is the plan. That is the plan.
Just, you know, they're just bringing more efficiency to government.
Oh, did you see Eric Trump tweeted by the dip on Tuesday? And then this announcement happened Sunday. I wonder if he was in a position to know something about the Bitcoin price.
Can we talk about Doge?
Please, I'd love to hear about Doge.
They're not batting 1,000 these days. The Times has a truly humiliating story about Doge taking credit for saving $53 million, supposedly, by ending a Coast Guard contract that lapsed 20 years ago and was only ever worth $144,000.
Yeah, Cry Me a River.
Tons of examples like that.
Justin Timberlake song for that.
Okay.
Go on.
There's so a lot of examples like that. They're just all over the place. Some of them they're correcting their mistakes, but they keep mistaking millions for billions. They're saying billions when they're actually cutting millions. It's a mess.
Yeah, they claim to have saved $8 billion on like a DEI program for ICE, when in fact it was an $8 million program.
Yes. So this is what's happening there. We also got word that Trump fired one of the last remaining career officials at USAID, Nicholas Enrich, who just wrote a series of memos to sound the alarm that despite Marco Rubio's promise to unfreeze all life-saving humanitarian assistance, the agency was, quote, never actually given the opportunity to implement life-saving humanitarian assistance, thanks to Doge canceling contracts, blocking payment systems, and just putting a bunch of obstacles in the way of getting the money out the door. Enrich projected another 166,000 deaths per year from malaria, another 200,000 children per year paralyzed with polio, more than 28,000 new cases of deadly diseases like Ebola and Marburg each year, and another 1 million children per year who won't be treated for severe acute malnutrition, which often kills them. So on this last point, I saw the CNN story over the weekend about this company in Georgia. What they do is they make this peanut paste. And they give this peanut paste, like, full of vitamins and nutrients, and they basically give this little packet to a child who's suffering from severe acute malnutrition, and they can survive. It's this, like, miracle thing. USAID has been handing it out for years and years and years. The company that produces this had, like, enough peanut paste for 400,000 kids, to save 400,000 kids, ready to go. Right on it, they said, like, from the American people, USAID, all in these packets, ready to go. The United States government had already purchased them. $10 million, we already paid for this, and was informed by Doge that the contract was canceled. And the guy's like, I have all this peanut paste now that's just going to go to waste. I can't send it anywhere because it's got USAID all over it. They told me not to do it. And that's it. So now all these kids aren't going to get the life-saving nutrition. So I see this thing. I get really annoyed. I tweet about it, and I was like, a tweet about Elon doing this with not even saving us money, just like not sending this stuff out. We already paid for it. And
it's Saturday night.
It's Saturday night. Yeah. I did. It was right before I saw you Saturday night.
Oh.
And I was on the way. I tweeted and then I got home and I'm in bed and I was like, oh, he responded.
My phone wasn't blowing up that night. Yeah. I was home alone.
You were home alone. And so Elon responded and he called me Dollar Store Jon Favreau. And said, I'm an imbecilic propagandist who lies to score cheap political points. And then he said, That said, I will investigate this.
So he's got you dead to rights.
All right,
so
he's going to do it anyway.
He's still figuring out the comment card thing.
he's like, and we'll fix it if so. And so then the next morning, so I decide, you know, it's late at night. Had a few drinks. I'm not going to reply now. So I just went to bed.
Well, good.
That was smart, right? Woke up in the morning. He has replied again. And he was like, the contract has been reinstated. It was already reinstated last week. They should get the payment soon. And he's like, and then he lists the company. I'm like, what company is that? It's another peanut paste company in Rhode Island that he had also canceled the contract to. And so I wrote back to him like, actually, that's great. But the company was in Georgia. It was at CNN. It was this company. And then later Sunday night, MJ Lee at CNN, who broke the original story about the Georgia company, was like, I just got a call from the guy in the Georgia company. And he said it was the contract was reinstated just minutes ago. So this morning, Elon was like, he replies to me again, and he was like, so just so you know, it wasn't because of the legacy media or Kmart favs.
He got upgraded.
He upgraded me.
Kmart better than Dollar Store?
Yeah.
Well, so. I had said that I would at least want to be Target John Favreau in my reply to him, because I thought I would, you know.
So now it's like a will there or won't there thing with these
things. I was trying to be constructive.
Sounds basically vaguely for Target.
How do you tweet this much from a K-hole?
I know, exactly. And he was like, it wasn't that. It was just, we just needed a brief pause, and no one has died yet. And what I said in the Oval about Ebola protection was right. It is turned back on, and it just takes a while for the money to go through all the systems and blah, blah, blah. Meanwhile, as he's tweeting this, I'm looking at this guy from USAID who just left and writing a memo like, no, Rubio gave all these waivers to the life-saving assistance, and none of them could be implemented.
The no one has died is like not the defense you like. It's the like if you're out there being like, I want to reassure everyone, no one has yet died.
As far as I know.
You know, like, first of all, great posting, by the way.
Yeah, good shit.
Great posting.
My New Year's resolution really coming in handy.
You
know what?
Remember when you and I were like, when he said his resolution was post more, and we like scoffed because like, why? What's the point? Paid for itself.
I mean,
paid for
good
itself.
For you. Also, I've been pivoting to TikTok because I'm just trying to reach people where they're at.
Yeah,
I'm doing a late mid 40s pivot to TikTok.
Don't let anyone tell you it's not going great.
It's going great.
It's going good.
43 is the year of vertical video.
I know.
I was trying to be nice.
Wow. I thought we were the same generation. But you go back to Elon in the cabinet meeting where he was, where he spoke to the cabinet before anyone else got a chance to speak. And he said, you know, I'm really support, you know, I'm here to support you. But the reason we're doing this is because we're in an emergency and we have to cut. If we want to hit my goal of $1.x trillion of cuts, we've got to cut $4 billion a day. That's the only way to do it. You got to cut $4 billion a day. And like, I do just, all of this is just exposing like how that is stupid at every level.
Right.
First of all, actually, you don't have to cut $4 billion a day. You don't have to scramble through the agencies finding little bits to cut every day. If you have a goal for a giant budget cut you want to make, you can propose it through Congress and you can do it. And by the way, go even one step further. Let's say you don't want to do it that way. You just said you have all these cabinet secretaries. Go to the cabinet secretaries and say, I need this. I need a proposal for this many cuts by this date. And I know it's going to be hard. And I'm going to be driving you guys every day. And I'm going to be meeting with you. But you tell me what we can cut. But no, one fucking adult tech bro cannot oversee these cuts across every layer of our government. It's going to lead to kids fucking dying.
Well, and this, you know, I had a friend ask me reading about all this. And he was like, well, but he's like, no. Isn't it possible that there is a lot of waste that we can get rid of there and that we also want to send out life-saving assistance? Like, why isn't both right? And I'm like, if they wanted to do that, they could have audited USAID. They could have used the authority that they have to trim where they could. And they could have then sent Congress a list, which they control, a list of cuts, a list of layoffs that they wanted to do. They could have done all that if the whole thing was about efficiency. I mean, Pete Hegseth, remember when he got to the Defense Department and was like, I want to cut the workforce by 8% at the department. So send me ideas for this by whatever. I'm not saying that Pete Hegseth has some strategic.
I love Pete Hegseth.
Why can't he follow the footsteps of a leader like Pete?
I saw that and I was like, well, if you want to cut your agency, that's one way to do it. Just like put out a goal. What they have done, this is not what they were doing at USAID.
What'd you say, 200,000 more kids getting polio?
Yeah.
I mean, we eradicated smallpox off the face of the earth. Like, the next goal was to eradicate polio, and I think it was only found in Afghanistan and Pakistan, the fact that it's now going to resurge because of these cuts, like, Jesus Christ, what a hit to humanity. On the USAID money generally, I do think, like, people are going to die. There are going to be refugee camps in Sudan where they're going to run out of food. Babies are going to die. There's going to be people we've been giving AIDS medicines under the PEPFAR program. That'll be gone in months. Now, there's going to be, I personally think that that is cruel and morally wrong and damaging to our standing in the world in the long term as a nation. But let's say your view on this is the United States can't feed every starving person anywhere, everywhere, and we can't be the world's policemen. Then you say to them, okay, what about programs that help people that we actively harmed as a nation, right? Early on in this process, we talked about the freeze on foreign aid, stopping programs that clean up unexploded bombs that the United States dropped on Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia. If we don't clean those up, little kids pick them up, their arms get blown off, they get killed, they're going to die. Like there was the New York Times recently had a story about a DOGE cut that cut off funding to a program that provides like the most meager amount of support to people who are severely disabled because of Agent Orange. Because the United States dropped Agent Orange on their villages during the Vietnam War, and then the people who lived there had kids who had these severe disabilities. Now we're cutting off loans to these people. Like, that's the reality of what's happening.
It's like, you know what? We are the richest country on Earth in the history of the Earth. And we are not... Elon Musk is worth $400 billion, okay? This is not like, hey, middle-class family in Ohio, we got to raise your taxes to help feed starving people in some other country. Like, we have billionaires running all over this country, and we're talking about 25-cent fucking peanut packets and malaria nets and HIV medication, which is now pretty cheap now that we've had it for... Like, what are we talking about right now? We can't fucking afford this.
And by the way, the end result of this is not reducing the deficit by whatever trillion-dollar goal Elon has set. They want to take that money, they want to put $100 billion of it into a crypto reserve, and they want to take the rest and they want to divvy it out to Elon Musk and all these people through a gigantic tax cut for the rich. And by the way, all the cuts Elon is making would never, even if he were to hit his goals, which he can't because he's doing this in such a chaotic and terrible way, even if he did, it would be obliterated by the cost of the tax cuts, which is why they have to go even further and look to cut Medicaid or look to cut Social Security or whatever they're going to do to try to pay for these giant tax cuts. So none of this results in any kind of tangible benefit for actual American citizens, right? Like, and by the way, none of this was part of, like, this was not the core of their campaign. They campaigned to lower the cost of goods. We are getting a dismantling of the federal government.
This podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. Whether you're just starting out or managing a growing brand, Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time all in one place, all on your terms. I'd like to buy some time from Squarespace.
That'd be nice. I'd like that.
Introducing Design Intelligence from Squarespace, combining two decades of industry-leading design expertise with cutting-edge AI technology to unlock your strongest creative potential. Design Intelligence empowers anyone to build a beautiful, more personalized website tailored to their unique needs and craft a bespoke digital identity to use across one's entire online presence.
Think we can doge things we don't like?
Oh, yeah.
About ourselves?
Yeah. Squarespace will help you doge stuff.
Nice.
Start a fully custom on-brand website with Squarespace's latest AI-enhanced website builder, Blueprint AI. After a few questions, our interactive design system transforms basic information about your brand or business into an elevated online presence. With curated premium quality content automatically added and matched to your profile and aesthetic. Upload video content, organize your video library, and showcase your content on beautiful video pages. You can even sell access to your video library by adding a paywall to your content. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/crooked to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com/crooked. Trump said late Monday, which is when we're recording this, that a 25% tariff on all Mexican and Canadian goods and an additional 10% tariff on all Chinese goods will go into effect on Tuesday. He backed off these tariffs at the last minute once before, so who knows if he'll do it again. Who knows why he changed his mind, but either way, stock market had the worst day of the year on Monday, and a lot of shit is about to get very expensive. Unless, of course, you're listening to this Tuesday morning and he backed off last minute again.
Right.
According to Bloomberg, for example, car prices alone would increase by $12,000 if the tariffs go through at the levels Trump is promising. This comes as the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta's estimate now predicts the economy to shrink by 2.8% this quarter. And a wave of new polling from CBS, Marist, CNN shows that people think that Trump is not doing enough to focus on the economy and inflation. His approval rating keeps dropping, but the weakest spot is economy and inflation, which is ironic because those used to be his strongest issues. It sure seems like a lot of flashing red lights for the Trump administration that they're just ignoring. Do you think they don't know, don't care? Do you think they think it's just temporary? What do you think?
I mean, this is what they want to do. That's just theory of the case. This is economic vision, is you throw up all these tariffs and somehow that will ultimately rebuild domestic manufacturing or our ability to produce goods. But it just feels very unlikely. And, you know, we're going to put in place these tariffs on Canada and Mexico, and they're going to retaliate. Like, the Canadians have talked about 25% tariffs on $30 billion worth of goods of U.S. products, and then that might expand to $85 billion more. And they're talking about ag products, consumer goods, liquor. I think they're targeting Republican districts, so like bourbon, appliances. And in Mexico has not been public about their retaliations, but they're preparing them. And so you made the point, like, the auto sectors are so entwined between the U.S. and Canada and Mexico, and I don't know how that's going to work. Mexico and Canada account for 70% of U.S. crude oil imports, so gas prices could go up. And also, we're talking about trade agreements that, like, Jared Kushner negotiated. The USMCA was the updated NAFTA that Trump, like, was one of the things Trump talked about as a primary accomplishment in the first term.
Yeah, and there was when he was first talking about the tariffs a couple of weeks ago, he said, I look at these deals, and I'm like, who negotiated these deals? You did. Yes. These are your deals. These are your deals.
He wants to squeeze our allies. He wants to squeeze them and get a better deal out of them and just keep squeezing them and squeezing them until they become the 51st, 52nd, 53rd, 54th state. I really think that this is part of it.
I'm sure that's right. Yeah.
He wants an economic war against Canada to just beat them into submission. And he's stupid because, like you said, it's going to hurt us.
So far it's backfiring. I mean, his ostensible political allies are the conservative parties up there. This guy, Pierre Poilievre, and he still might be the next Canadian prime minister. But Justin Trudeau's polling was like rock bottom. He stepped back. They did this thing where it's called proroguing parliament, where basically the Liberal Party is now going to figure out its new leader, and that person will then become the prime minister when they go back into session in like a couple weeks. And the Liberal Party's polling numbers, because of Trump's attacks, have gone way back up.
Yeah.
Like, he is rallying support, and you're seeing Canadians booing the national anthem and all this sort of Canadian nationalism, and it's not working.
He might be, you know, Trump might lead to a resurgence of the center left all over the world, except here, I guess.
That'd be cool.
Yeah, well, here we've already been sort of beaten to a bloody pulp, but I was thinking about just sort of Trump as this negotiator, right? And like, it's kind of an old saw at this point that he'd be richer today if he had just taken his inheritance and put it in the S&P, mm-hmm. right? Because he's just not a very good businessman. And like, you kind of see in how he is president why he was such a bad businessman, which is he can't think long term. Yeah. He can't think strategically. And so like,
very short term.
You know, you look at tariffs, and you say, all right, your goal was to build up domestic manufacturing, and you want tariffs to be one lever in doing that, right? Well, some of the things you're tariffing, right? It would take a decade to build a steel plant, right? Take a decade to improve our capacity in whatever it might be, refining oil, whatever. Like, putting on the tariff doesn't result in that at all. We're actually completely dependent on Canada and Mexico for a lot of parts, a lot of supplies, a lot of materials, right? And so like, all of this is so, it's astrategic. It's just a guy who had an idea about what makes you put on the tariffs, the manufacturing comes back. And maybe there's some like very raw sense in which that's on some level true. But in the meantime, there's just a decade of pain, yeah. of economic stagnation. And then the question is, if that does come, right? Like, you know, we're going to talk about the Democrats, and I believe that's how you pronounce it. but it, like, we like, what happens when we move from things could get really bad to things are really bad, and right, like, how does that change Trump, and then how does that change how the American people feel about our response?
Well, Democrats are continuing to workshop their response strategy in public, as we like to do.
Great.
One spicy take on this came last week from the Raging Cajun himself, James Carville, who wrote in a New York Times op-ed, quote, "With no clear leader to voice our opposition and no control in any branch of government, it's time for Democrats to embark on the most daring political maneuver in the history of our party. Roll over and play dead. Allow the Republicans to crumble beneath their own weight and make the American people miss us." Unsurprisingly, actual elected Democrats have thoughts on this. Here's Bernie Sanders on Meet the Press this Sunday.
The problem is the Democrats have been playing dead for too many years. I don't think you play dead. I think you stand up for the working class of this country and make the point. 13 of the people that he nominated to head agencies are billionaires. Their greed is uncontrollable. We've got to fight back. That's what these trips to Wisconsin and Michigan will be about.
Just right down the middle for Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, it's just like, sort of like, oh,
what a question. Are you kidding
should
me?
Democrats fight or give up? Bernie, what do you
Your
think?
Your take? What do you guys think about Carville's prescription?
So, first of all, so when I was reading it, I sort of like asked myself a question before I got to the answer. And the question was, does a strategic retreat mean we help them fund the government? Or does strategic retreat mean we don't help them fund the
That's
government?
That's a good question.
Right? And like, so, and then you kind of get to it. He says, like, actually, we should hang back for a while. It's not totally clear, but like kind of come in at the last minute when they've already shown themselves to be terrible and failures and chaotic, and then come in at the last second and say what we stand for and help reopen the government, for example. And it sort of gets at, I think, the problem here, which is I think when you talk about like, should the Democrats fight or should they retreat in an abstraction? Like, I don't really know how you like act on this, right? Like, he's doing terrible things. Should Chris Murphy not go to the floor and talk about them?
Should he walk around like this?
Yeah, like, should we like I have no comment on the dismantling of NATO today. Yeah. Like, that's just not how it works.
Duct tape your mouth.
So I don't think
that's what James meant.
No, of course not. And so like, what I took it to mean is like kind of sensationalistic way of saying Democrats have to be strategic. But like, all in all, where I land after reading it is like, I don't know what we get by hanging back. It's not like we get credits later when we speak more forcefully for the times we were quiet earlier on.
Yeah, I just think like Trump is the most relentless messenger in the history of politics. And I think we can't let him talk in a vacuum or else like he's going to pin every failure on Democrats, and some not insignificant part of the electorate will think that egg prices are high because of Gaza protesters at Barnard. You know what I mean? And so,
and that's not true.
And that, as far as I know, that is not true.
It's the Jews.
And
still
I do think
just the Jews.
I think you're right, Lovett. Like, it's smarter to talk about these fights around a specific thing like the budget. But I do think we have an opportunity there to drive a message that's really strong, which is that Donald Trump is allowing this unelected, unwell billionaire to break the U.S. government so that he could pretend it's going to save enough money to pay for a $5 trillion tax cut for the richest people in the country. And I think that's a good story. We have a good villain in Elon Musk. But we're not going to win this fight with like op-eds and, you know, MSNBC hits. It's going to be a volume game on social media and platforms and local press. But I do think like part of this is like
has been seeing us on Chris Hayes lately, I guess. And the points we're making there.
But like, I do think we have to have a motivation. We have to have a story with an enemy, and we have to have an alternative.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
And
let's get to that.
There is a long tradition in politics, and I think this is both parties do this, which is like when, you know, your opposition is fucking up, you just stand back, and if you put out an alternative, then the opposition, you know, then the other party is just going to start taking shots at your alternative, and then people aren't going to like your alternative, and blah, 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 and why don't you just stand back? And I get the reasoning behind that, but I also think that we are at a moment now where people are so cynical about politics, tired, beat down, and unimpressed with the Democratic Party, to say it nicely. Like, the party has one of the worst approval ratings it's had ever. And I think it is incumbent upon Democrats right now more than ever to like offer a vision, offer an alternative, say what we would do differently. I don't think we need to like, you know, have a blizzard of policy plans out there at all, but I think we need to, as we critique Trump, like lay out how we would govern differently, how we treat people differently, what our vision of the country looks like, what our vision of the world looks like. Like, I don't know. I mean, look, we've tried, well, we're not Trump and we're not MAGA a couple times now. It didn't work in 2016. It barely worked in 2020. It didn't work in 2024. It might work in 2026 because it's a midterm electorate, but like, we got to think about 2028 here. And we also got to think about just expanding the map in general, because we're never going to win this. Like, going the way we are, we're not going to control the Senate with the states we have. The Electoral College could shift, and we're going to need to like pick up more states. And like, we're just going to have to compete in tough places, which means you're going to have to give people an alternative.
Yeah. I mean, Trump, like, before the election, Trump went to New York and said, I'm going to win New York. And obviously that was ridiculous. But you had a Republican politician saying, I can foresee a day where we win in this state, right? And like, it's similar, honestly, to like the kind of managed decline globally. It's like there's sort of like a managed decline to the Democratic brand. Like, oh, we can't win in a state like Wyoming. We can't win in a state like Nebraska, even though in those states, minimum wage bills, union bills, marijuana bills, abortion bills, they pass, right? And so that tells you that there's this big delta between what people actually want in their lives and the Democratic brand. And we won't make that brand better. We won't fix it by being silent. Now, what I do think is also true is we won't fix it by just being kind of like whiners on the sidelines. And I think that's the point he makes that did resonate with me, which is like Democrats are powerless. It sucks. We're telling the truth about Trump. He's fucking terrible, but we've been saying it for years. And by the way, the part of the problem is we were warning for years about how bad it could get. It is now as bad as it could get, and it's no longer a warning, but it sounds like what people have heard before. That is not our fault. That is a collective problem with our democracy, a weakness Donald Trump exposes. But it is the reality of like, and which is why I think where you get to is like, we just need to offer an alternative. We need to offer something that isn't about Trump. And like, I am even open to some of the more kind of like kooky ideas of like, of people saying this is what our cabinet would be doing right now, right? Like I'm like open
you want a shadow
to,
cabinet.
I'm not
Look
against
at you.
It.
You're
I'm
all
not
British.
Against it. I'm not against the shadow cabinet.
Join the Labor Party, start spelling it with an OU.
I'm up for Trump. Yeah, sure. sure.
I agree that we shouldn't overpromise and pick fights that give people the impression that we have power we don't have. Right, because that is a problem too. Is you're like we're gonna fight. And we're gonna stop them, and then it's like obviously we knew we couldn't stop them because we don't have the votes for X or Y. Right, like so I agree it's important not to overpromise, but I still think like you need to fight when you can and just be honest about what power we have and what power we don't.
The Trump people are gonna break some parts of the government, and people are gonna get hurt, and they have to understand why that happened.
Yes.
So we've talked about the DOE stuff, but there's another thing that's gonna happen. So in 2020. Congress passed a bunch of tax credits to make Affordable Care Act plans more affordable. Mm. Those were extended through 2025. Those are going to expire. And if they are not reauthorized, you're going to see a bunch of middle-class people see like serious premium increases. We need to explain to them as Democrats why their premiums are going up. Otherwise, it might just happen in a vacuum. And people are going to think, oh, actually, government healthcare sucks.
It's Trump. Trump will say Obamacare sucks.
Yeah, or the Obamacare sucks. No, we have to explain that because the Democrats in Congress passed these enhanced tax credits for the Affordable Care Act. We need a better name for them, by the way. And the
it's
Republican
actually expanded
Party.
Expanded premium support, Tommy.
Thank you. That's even worse. And Republicans let them lapse.
Yeah. No, I mean, look, I do think that the budget fight is the fight to
for
do
sure.
this. And
for
I
sure.
get, but I also, I'm already like, can I just, we're heading into the budget fight and I'm already feeling like the most popular testing message just coming right back up and everyone's just going to be like tax cuts for billionaires to cut your healthcare. And it's the right message. But I think we have to be creative in the way we talk about it. Like we just can't sound like we have sounded like the last 20 years. So it is the right argument. It's the, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
When I say the right message, that doesn't necessarily mean the right words. You know?
I know. It's hard.
Can't you feel it already?
I know. It's hard, right? Because it's like part of it is like, you need to be doing two things, right? You actually do need to use the messages that resonate with people because we're in a short-term fight and you're trying to make the argument that resonates with people. But at the same time, we're trying to make up for what is like ultimately like a huge credibility gap. Like we warned the country for several elections in a row about how dangerous Donald Trump was. It was very, very clear. People did not enough people believed us. Not enough people cared. Either we didn't reach them or if we did, they didn't take it at face value. And so that like requires like a deeper you just start telling a deeper story about what you believe about the world, and it's going to challenge people's assumptions. It's not going to be exactly what they expect to hear from you.
Yeah, or, I mean, Tommy, you've made this joke many times, which is, like, Democrats have been using the line, we're going to stop tax breaks for companies that ship jobs overseas, and we're going to give those tax breaks to companies who create jobs in America for 20 years more.
Yeah.
And so, like, is that one of the best polling testing lines? Yeah. I bet it is. And I bet when you ask people about it, they'll be like, yeah, I really like that. Like, it's not just polls. People well, but then
work hard and play by the rules.
If you say it for 20 years and it doesn't happen, yeah. And you just keep saying the same line, it's not going to land well.
One thing that I think insulates Trump from a lot of criticism is people think, well, he's rich. He's not trying to make more money. Because somehow people have gotten it in their heads that billionaires don't always want more money, and that's how you become a billionaire. I think we need to undercut that by exposing the reality. For example, the Washington Post reported that Elon Musk and his businesses have received at least $38 billion in government contracts, loans, subsidies, and tax credits. We need to lift that up as he's slashing things through a DOGE or advocating for a $4.5 trillion tax cut for the richest people in the world. Like, That's the kind of stuff I think where there's an enemy and it's newsworthy and it's new and it's interesting. I think we can sell that.
Everything the tech oligarchs have done in the last 10 years does not suggest that they do not care about their wealth.
Well, there's these people cannot get enough and it's fucking sick. But they, like, I don't know. This is where I kind of come back. Like, I see what Carville's getting at, right? Because like what he's saying is like we kind of need to step back from the daily grind to figure out what we mean and what we stand for. And I guess the like where I land is like there's a lot of different Democrats that need to do a lot of different things. We need the people out there fighting every single day. Like the days of like everybody driving towards one single message are probably over. There's like maybe a core message we're driving, but there's like a bunch of different access points to it. And some people like Jasmine Crockett are going to be better at just sort of like going for the fucking jugular. And some people are going to be a bit more academic, like a Pete Buttigieg, but also in a really effective way. Like there's just there's just going to be a bunch of different ways to talk about this.
And then you've got your Gen Xers pivoting to vertical video and TikTok.
Right.
I reject that.
And I think you're doing a great job.
You're the Doge of this podcast with all your fucking falsehoods in this episode.
Yeah.
I think like we have to remember it's a party. A list is not a message, right? We have to tell a story. It's got to be, there is like a lot of work we have to do as a party. Like there's a bit of a reboot of like who we, like you say, who is Trump? What is he? People are like, I don't know. He wants to make America great again. Sounds stupid. We used to make fun of it, but like, boy, is that simple and effective. We don't need a slogan, but we need people to think like Democrats are like, they believe this, they stand for that, they fight for this. Like we need to
stronger at home, more respected in the world, and opportunity for all and bottom up, middle out, middle
strength
class,
plus experience plus equals change.
Change.
The like
middle out, bottom up.
This is like this
mega
is
mega,
mega, mega, mega, mega. W stands for wrong, John. But that's an old deep cut. But like, this is like Bill Maher left, so we didn't really get into it. But it's like, everybody in the like, when you make the argument,
was it as sexually charged as it felt?
I mean, I came, but like, you made like sex. Don't push me. Don't push me. But
you came, he left.
You don't think 69 exists? What are we doing right now, Bill? But like
little treat for all of you who stayed through an hour 20.
We're having a great time. We're having a great time.
You have to kick the dogs out at the beginning of us.
But the this idea that like, once you've made the argument and they don't want to push back in the argument, it's like, oh, you're going to cost Democrats elections for 20 years with this pro-trans stuff. And it's like, Donald Trump put a pro-choice environmental lawyer at the head of the Department of Health and Human Services because he had built up so much trust and credibility with his base. And he has so much power within his party that he had the space to operate, to challenge orthodoxies in a bunch of different ways, both before he became president and after. And like as a Democratic Party, to Tommy's point, like we need to have a core set of beliefs, of values that are so clear, so that make so much sense to people that you then have the space to kind of like take to challenge people on an issue they may not be agree with you yet, right? To actually lead.
I'm laughing because I thought about like on the Democratic side and I was like, Kamala Harris did three events one day with Liz Cheney and we're still hearing about how it was, that's what caused the end of the election.
But I actually, honestly, I know.
She didn't even say like, you think she was like barnstorming with Liz Cheney and like promising her a cabinet seat.
Yeah, like she's, it's more like, what if Kamala Harris said, I'm going to make Mike Pence my Secretary of Health and Human Services. Could you imagine? But like, why is that so inconceivable? It's because honestly, Kamala Harris, the most work she had to do was not just proved, she had to prove to every single group of people what she believed in, right? She had no trust with the left. She had no trust with the center. She was starting from fucking scratch.
Well, on the other side of it too, just to prove I'm not just a Liz Cheney fan, you know, AOC, one of the best messengers in the party, and we couldn't even get her a ranking member slot because on the oversight committee.
When you have a talent like Connolly, when you have a once in a generation communicator like Connolly just waiting in the wings.
I do think that there's a lesson from the RFK thing where, look, he's a terrible person. I would not want him part of the Democratic coalition. And I don't think
great op-ed on measles, though.
I don't think it was a mistake for Kamala Harris not to like cut a deal with him or whatever. Remember, that was kind of a narrative.
Yeah.
But Republicans, they will let anyone into the tent, including him. And they saw, Donald Trump correctly saw that RFK overthrew decades of misleading and, you know, sort of being emotionally manipulative to people who had children with disabilities, et cetera, had built this constituency and built trust with a community that was like pretty significant. And they saw the value of this kind of like wellness to anti-vax to MAGA to MAHA pipeline. And they were willing to go for it. And I don't know, like, it's not a good example. It's not something I'd like to emulate, but that openness and willingness to bring people into the tent is something.
It sounds like what you're saying is we need a Joe Rogan of the left.
Of the right. Need to 69.
All right, we're going to end this thing now. That's our show for today. Reminder that we're going to be live streaming our preview of Trump's address to the joint session tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll have a bonus reaction show in your feed tomorrow morning. Talk to y'all then. If you want to listen to Pod Save America ad-free or get access to our subscriber Discord and exclusive podcasts, consider joining our Friends of the Pod community at crooked.com/friends or subscribe on Apple Podcasts directly from the Pod Save America feed. Also, be sure to follow Pod Save America on TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube for full episodes, bonus content, and more. And before you hit that next button, you can help boost this episode by leaving us a review and by sharing it with friends and family. Pod Save America is a Crooked Media production. Our producers are David Toledo and Saul Rubin. Our associate producer is Farah Safari. Reed Cherlin is our executive editor, and Adrian Hill is our executive producer. The show is mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick. Jordan Cantor is our sound engineer with audio support from Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis. Madeline Herringer is our head of news and programming. Matt DeGroat is our head of production. Naomi Sengel is our executive assistant. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn, Haley Jones, Phoebe Bradford, Joseph Dutra, Ben Hefcoat, Mia Kelman, Molly Lobel, Kirill Pelaviv, and David Tolles. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.